So season one of Unpopular is over. I hope that you've listened to the entire season and also have enjoyed the entire season. If you haven't, feel free to go back and listen to all the episodes and let us know what you think about them. But in the meantime, before season two launches, we're going to have a few conversations with people who I think that you would really love to hear from. Today's bonus interview is going to be with Dr. Rebecca Hall, who has done a lot of research on women who led slave revolts. Women often get left out of the conversation of slave revolts, and I think her research and her work is really awesome and really relevant to the topic of resistance and people who have been forgotten and the legacies of those people and what we can learn from them. So we're going to do things a little bit differently today. I'm going to get off my lonely solo soapbox to have a conversation with Dr. Rebecca Hall, and I hope you enjoy it. Here we go.
My name is Dr. Rebecca Hall. Rebecca is R-E-B-E-C-C-A, last name Hall, H-A-L-L. I'm a JD PhD, meaning I have a law degree and a PhD, because I wanted all the student debt. I got my JD from Berkeley in 1989 and practiced law for 8 years. I worked with homeless families and did tenants' rights work, and then went on to go back and get my PhD to study history of race and gender.
So how would you define slave revolt?
Yeah, so that's a very interesting question to start with. Historians, you know, who study slave revolt use different definitions depending on sort of almost kind of like what work they want the term to do. So, you know, there's slave resistance where slaves are fighting back against either, you know, their specific situation or against slavery generally. For you know, there are historians who believe that slave resistance is not a full revolt unless it's trying to bring down the entire institution of slavery. Some people have definitions that a slave revolt has to involve, you know, a certain number of people, has to have a certain type of coverage or documentation in the press at the time. My definition is any coordinated act of violent resistance against slavery orders or their specific slaveholders. And the reason why I define it like that is because, as we'll get into, women are written out of the history of being involved in slave revolts. One of the things that keeps coming up is that, you know, women aren't involved in violent acts of resistance. They're coordinated violent acts of resistance. So I use the term that historians specifically use to exclude women, say that, okay, this, I'm going to look for this particular type of slave resistance and show that women are involved in it.
So I'll say that one reason that I came to your work and was just, you know, really interested in this topic that we're talking about today, women who led slave revolts, is because I was, like, for, you know, obvious reasons, turning to slave revolts as acts that people used as resistance in terms of challenging the status quo that was slavery. And a lot of those people had, you know, very, very interesting stories and, you know, resisted in different ways, even within the practice of slave revolts. And mm-hmm. I realized that where are the women? Like, you know, in cursory searches, definitely there are no women that really pop up. And when they do pop up, it's kind of like, this is the same story that's told over and over. What's the deeper story here? What are the beginnings of the story? And what did they actually mm-hmm. do? And, you know, the story's just kind of a surface. Look at these, you know, amazing women who did this, but doesn't really allow a person who's just jumping into that search, who's maybe not a historian or a researcher, to learn more about them. And that was just, I knew that was a measured absence. It wasn't just because women were silent. And I would love to know what got you into researching women who led slave revolts.
Okay, yeah. So I've always been interested in the issue of slave resistance and slave revolts, and by always, I mean since I was a child. I think, you know, I had, my parents were radical activists, and, you know, any group of people, any oppressed group of people, having access to the history of how we fought back is crucial, because it tends to be silenced on purpose. And it's also important for our basic psychological makeup, you know, like I think of, you know, people like, you know, Kanye West or whatever it is that, well, they must have consented to slavery. I mean, he didn't say it this articulately, but because, you know, they didn't fight back or, and in fact, you know, there were hundreds of slave revolts in the United States. And the history of slave revolt in specific, it was actively erased by historians. So I think it's important for me to answer your question, to talk a little bit about what happened with the history of slave revolt generally, and then talk about how its recovery actually then erased women participation in it. Is okay if I go in there?
Yes, that's fine.
With that question,
of course.
Okay. Yeah. So you know, the first, you know, historians of slavery were people who supported slavery and said, you know, slaves didn't resist to slavery because, you know, the institution was benign and necessary for Black people in order to attain their culture. And that's why there's no slave revolt that happened in the United States. You know, and it's hard to ignore the ones like Haiti or some of the huge ones in South America. And so these historians were saying, well, slavery was harsher there, but here we had it right. It was good, you know. And that was how slave resistance in general, and slave revolt was taught, you know, all the way up through the 1950s in this country. And then you started to get some historians, especially after World War II, making comparisons and saying, well, there weren't slave revolts in the United States because, like in concentration camps, slavery was such a horrible institution, they would say such a totalizing institution, that it was impossible to resist slavery, just like in concentration camps. But of course, that's not true for concentration camps either, but that's another episode. And then, you know, in the 60s and early 70s, you start getting African-Americans, primarily men, involved in academia and the rise of Black studies, also in the context of sort of, you know, the civil rights movement. And these historians start saying, wait a minute, there actually were plenty of slave revolts. Look at all this evidence for them. But at the same time, they were saying that, you know, there's this big sort of cultural background issue that, you know, still exists to this day, is the idea that the Black family's problem with Black people and why Black people don't succeed is because their family's dysfunctional, their men are emasculated, that women are matriarchs, this happened in slavery, this will never be changed until the Black family gets its act together and its gender roles correct. Right. Mm-hmm. And this is the whole dysfunctional Black family thesis. Right. And then you have, you know, Angela Davis writing an article on Black women in the community of slaves while she's actually in prison, asking scholars, how can you say that women had the power in slavery? This doesn't make any sense. Right. But in response to this pushback, you know, you have everything from like activists, Black activists like Stokely Carmichael saying, when being asked, you know, what's the position of Black women in the liberation struggle? And he responds, prone, you know, to Black male historians writing these books on recovering the history of slave revolt and repeatedly saying, but women weren't involved in this.
Right.
Women didn't do this because they performed their gender roles correctly. And men were manly. And so there's this like huge pushback happening, right? And so then, you know, you could get in the 70s and 80s, you could get a rise of feminist historians, you know, women of black and white, you know, all, and they were saying, okay, all right, so if women didn't figure prominently in slave revolt, they were very figured prominently in slave resistance generally. So, but their acts were more individual, less violent, you know, but and also possibly more effective, right? So trying to highlight resistance on a broad scale, which is always a good thing, right? You know, but they never went back and questioned the fundamental assumption about women and their act. And so when I got into graduate school and I wanted to study slave revolts and slave resistance, and I kept seeing these, you know, every book I picked up, like, it'll be like, okay, it's going to be, you know, within the first 30 pages, there's going to be some statement about how women didn't do this, you know? Mm-hmm. I was like, there's something wrong about this. Mm-hmm. So everything I just told you, this is what I ended up learning, right? And I was like, I bet there are women involved, and this is what I want to do my dissertation research on. And my dissertation advisor is like, well, even if that's true, you're not going to find the records. There's mm-hmm. not going to be sources. And so, but that's what someone needs to do, is just tell me I can't do something. So then I started finding women all over the primary sources. And so that became my work, my dissertation, that, and my PhD. I have published academic articles about it. And I have a forthcoming graphic novel about it, where that I write and that's being illustrated by an artist, is about what I, you know, about the story of how this history was sort of buried and why, and how to uncover it, what the process a person needs to go through to actually uncover and sort of recover the stories of women in the archives, you know, who fought and died leading slave revolts and participating in slave revolts.
So who are some of those women who fought in slave revolts?
So I think it's important for me to sort of situate myself as a historian. Like, you have to specialize in a time period and place. And my focus is British America in the 18th century, right? I mean, that's how specific you need to focus. There are women, like, if you study, you know, in Latin America, and there are women named in some of the revolts that happened in Cuba. I don't have the names off the top of my head. But here in what became the United States, I've done a lot of my research on two revolts in colonial New York, one in 1708, which I'm the one who uncovered, and then at 1712. A revolt in 1712. So the 1708 revolt, there were four slaves executed for killing a family of slaveholders, and they were prevented from killing others. And the woman, the three men involved were hung, and the woman was burned at the stake. Her name was never recorded. She was referred to as the Negro Wench or the Negro Fiend. And I spent a year trying to find her name.
Yeah.
And it may be that we never find it.
Mm-hmm.
There was actually a trial. And if there was a trial, there was a court record. But I've been told at several archives throughout New York that those records were destroyed in a fire. There was a bunch of the big fire in New York that destroyed a lot of its historical records. I still haven't given up. There's a couple leads I can still track down, but I looked for her name here in New York and also in England, because it was the English colony at the time. In 1712, there were four women whose names are in the court record for that revolt: Sarah, Abigail, Amba, and Lily. Two of those women were convicted, Sarah and Abigail, and two, Lily and Amba, were acquitted. the two who were convicted were sentenced to death. And one of those women, and it's not clear in the court records which one, whether it was Sarah or Abigail, had her execution stayed because she was pregnant. This was done not because out of sort of any kindness to the mother. It's because someone owns that baby.
Right.
Then there's a lot of correspondence between the colonial governor of New York at the time and Queen Anne's Privy Council. He's requesting a pardon for her, saying, you know, she's given birth. She's been in the jail, you know, her condition's in a woeful state. But he never received his permission for the pardon. And it's never mentioned whether it was Sarah or Abigail. These are the kind of minefields you come across researching slavery in general, but particularly when you try to research, you know, when you're going back this far, you know, this isn't an antebellum period. This is early during the establishment of slavery. There were three other women unnamed who committed suicide before capture. And it's an interesting thing, which will be talked about more in the graphic novel, but it can be traced by the names of the slaves. There were, I think, 21 tried altogether. Amba is an Akan name, Akan speaking language from what is now Ghana, and a large percentage of the slaves involved were Akan speaking. There's been really sort of a lot of documentation of methods and types of resistance of people in the Akan diaspora. So from that information and contrasted with colonial records, I was able to discover like the kind of oath that they took in preparation for the revolt, and also the incentive to either win the fight, die in the fight, or kill yourself or commit suicide. Because you, not just because you don't want to be captured, tortured, and killed, there's that, but also because if that happens, if you die in the fight or kill yourself before capture, you join the ancestral plane and can continue the fight. So those are some names, and I have more information about those people. But again, it's a little tricky because I'm not exactly sure what happened to which one of them. You know, my educated guess, I mean, one was definitely executed immediately after the revolt, and because only the queen could issue a pardon, and it never came, I'm assuming that she was executed. But the Queen Anne, died before responding to letters, and there was a new king, and the governor got reassigned, and then the record just falls silent.
We'll be back with more conversation with Dr. Rebecca Hall soon, but we're going to take a quick break. In the work that you do reclaiming the history and the memory of people and really uncovering stories that haven't, you know, seen much light, if any at all, and also how you talked about, you know, this women in slavers revolts for several reasons have been excluded. There's a mention in your work of an event called Celia's Conspiracy.
Mm-hmm.
And one thing that I'm very interested in is language. And you talk about...
In my article, you mean?
In your article, yes.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And you talk about how you specifically choose, because Celia wasn't mentioned, but she was mentioned as being someone who was instrumental in the event. And
exactly.
Labeling it Celia's Conspiracy very intentionally to put her name up front at the top of that, the naming of it. So what is the significance Can you tell me about your feelings about the significance of naming and using language when it comes to reclaiming women's stories when it came to resistance and slave revolts?
Sure, absolutely. Okay, so you know, we've already talked about how women's involvement in revolt, and we definitely should talk about slave ship revolts too. But that women were involved in and led slave revolts, and that act, and the different ways and reasons why that was erased. One of the things is that if, you know, the historian goes to the record assuming that this is not something women did, then they're never going to name a slave revolt after the women involved. So many slave revolts are named after who people at the time decided was a leader, or who historians subsequently decided was a leader. You know, the Denmark Vesey revolt, the Nat Turner revolt, you know, they're named after specific men. And in this revolt that you're referring to, you know, there's a detailed interrogation of one of the enslaved men involved in the revolt, where he talks about this woman, Celia, and how he had inspired this revolt and planned it. But they don't ask, the interrogators at the time don't ask any questions. They don't ask any more questions about this woman who decided the time, decided, you know, organized it. And so that's just the kind of silencing that happens, both at the time because of gender assumptions and also by subsequent silencing by current historians because of their gendered assumptions.
You mentioned slave ship revolts.
Yeah.
What?
Okay, so go ahead.
No, I was just going to ask, what was it that is, you know, so compelling about slave ship revolts?
Okay, well, first of all, this is really, this is, I think, a very important issue in the history or historiography of slavery in general, slave resistance in specific. For a long time, historians thought that revolts on slave ships were very rare, mainly because it was basically suicidal. You know, if you're in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean and, you know, you don't come from a culture that's technology that knows how to, you know, operate ships or whatever, your best case scenario is, you know, you're going to die and take the white people who are enslaving you with you. So people thought, yeah, it's just, it didn't happen very often. But then with the rise of sort of digital capacity and digital humanities, historians all over the world who are studying the Atlantic slave trade, you know, we're talking about hundreds and thousands of slave ships, were pulling their information into a centralized database. And in the 90s, you know, it was set up so that you could actually query the database. And what they found out was that there was a slave ship revolt on 1 in 10 voyages, which was really shocking. And I'm not an economic historian, but it had a really big impact on, for example, costs associated with the trade. There's analyses that show that it prevented others from being traded. It made the cost, you know, because of the costs and the issues involved. But I have done a lot of reading about issues of prevention about slave ship revolts. But then when these quantitative historians, you know, when they looked at the data and they wanted to say, okay, why would there be a revolt on one ship and not another? Like, what's the, you know, big difference between the two ships, types of ships that, you know, where there's a revolt? And the number one difference was that on the ships where there were more revolts, there were more women. And the historians, seeing that, you know, specifically said, but we know women weren't involved in this type of organized, violent, active resistance, so this must be like a statistical fluke. Mm-hmm. But when I, you know, was in England going through hundreds and hundreds of slave ship captain logs and ship surgeons logs that, you know, describe and insurance reports that document this, it becomes very clear, like in England, that the practice was that women were, once the ship had left the African coast, while on the coast, everybody was chained below deck because there was a fear of what they call cutoffs, where people from Africa would come and attack the ship and free the enslaved people on it. Once the ship was in the Atlantic and away from the possibility of cutoff, women were kept on deck and unchained. And for some pretty, you know, nefarious reasons, you know, in terms of crew having access to women, et cetera, but also because there was a thought that, you know, these women aren't really a danger, but that's also where the weapons were kept. And so you can see, and, you know, captains report repeatedly things like, you know, anything from, we had a third revolt, you know, and, but we keep checking the men's chains and we don't understand how these people, you know, are being killed. Or, you know, the women, or they'll actually mention the women, like the women got hold of the weapons and, or freed men below, or women were the ones who did the entire revolt. And this is, I think this is a really important story about slave ship revolts and resistance. And that, you know, that has just been erased, it, both in the ways, again, the way people documented things at the time and the way historians later looked at the records. There's this amazing book written by Michel Rolf Chariot. He's a Haitian historian called Silencing the Past. And he looks at this sort of back and forth process of how records are, how what's documented impacts how we understand. You know, it's easy to say, oh, history's written by the victors, but that's a generalized statement that doesn't tell us very much. You know, we have to understand the ways in which people are written out if we're going to recover them. He gives an example, which I thought was really useful, of you know, silencing that happens in the actual chronicling of an event. Now, you think somebody's chronicling events, that they're getting everything down, you know. And his example is like, okay, a baseball game. You go to a baseball game. I don't go to a baseball game. I find them deadly boring. But anyway, you go to a baseball game, and you've got the sportscaster person who's announcing, like, the first is at bat, and there's the second run, and the whatever they, you know. But they're not talking about how many hot dogs were sold in the stands, right?
Right.
Because it's irrelevant. It's irrelevant. And so, similarly, you know, if you can't see that women are capable of violent acts of, you know, resistance, you're not recording them.
Exactly.
You know?
Yeah.
And you know, and you know, the assumptions that are made, I mean, a lot of the cultures from which people were treated had quite developed female martial traditions, you know? So the idea that suddenly women who come from cultures where they in fact, you know, fight as soldiers or regularly defend their villages or whatever, you know, are suddenly like stereotypes of European women who, you know, wouldn't do that. Again, those are stereotypes. So there's a lot of pieces at work, a lot of moving parts.
Let's take a short break and we'll be back with Dr. Rebecca Hall afterward. It's already a lot of people who are, there's historical revisionism or, you know, negating things that happened in the past. Like, it's already hard for a lot of Americans to come to terms with the fact that slavery happened and has consequences. And just you pointing out, well, even within the history that's written and that's told in, you know, people calling slaves wage laborers or whatever it was they called in that that U.S. textbook. That's already what people are learning today. And the fact that you're saying that, you know, things, even the history that is written is also very, there's a lot of nuance to it where it's like there are a lot of things that were left out. So it just seems like getting mm-hmm. people to go even beyond, you know, the negating that they're doing of history that actually happened, to understand that history happened, but there's also, even what's written, you know, may seem solid and may seem like it's written, so that's what happened. Like, no, there's even a layer beyond that that we have to discover, right. who people like you are uncovering these types of things. It just makes right. me, I try not to be too cynical or too, you know, pessimistic about mm-hmm. it, but when I see that people are, you know, denying things like the Holocaust that have histories that are that you really can't deny, but are being denied.
Right, right. Right.
And it makes me feel a little bit, you know, discouraged sometimes. But, you know, I mm-hmm. it's really good to know, you know, that I can, you know, speak to people like you who are constantly uncovering mm-hmm. things. That makes me feel a lot better. So that's just my own personal right. you know, feelings and just kind of fear, you know, of like how we look back at history and how we continue to learn about history and realize that we were wrong and that we can change and that things change. That's my personal feelings.
Yeah, no, I get it. And when I present this work, I've been doing a lot of presenting of the work outside of sort of academic circles since getting involved in the graphic novel writing process. And I see how strong what a strong emotional impact it has on people, on African-Americans in particular, how empowering they find this work. And it reminds me, you know, yeah, it's not just me. It's not just some weird thing I'm interested in. This is something really important, you know. Mm-hmm. And I have, you know, also taught high school. And the way slavery and the slave trade is taught is itself a crime. It, you know, it's just horrific. Mm-hmm. So I've seen, you know, where people, you know, usually like I would go to an event and be like, okay, can someone raise your hand if you, you know of a slave revolt? And, you know, a couple hands will go up, you know, like maybe Nat Turner, you know. Mm-hmm. It's people don't, they just, you know, history is a dangerous thing, and it's not taught. I mean, and so, you know, I'm hoping to be able to intervene in that, you know, by using this graphic novel format and being able to, you know, get this book, you know, because it's got picked up by a major publisher, by Simon & Schuster. But, you know, being able to get this something that can be assigned, you know, in colleges and high schools as well. And, you know, I don't know if you followed the blowback that's happened since the New York Times 1619
yes.
stories. But, I mean, like,
yeah,
it's incredible.
Yeah.
You know, it's just the people just, they don't want to, I mean, they, you know, uh-huh. conservative centrists, they don't want to hear it. Uh-huh. They, you know.
So, speaking of the 1619 Project, I would like to know how your experience, you know, you're immersed in these stories of slave revolt and resistance and Black resistance in history, but at the same time, you know, we're constantly creating stories of Black resistance and revolt. And how is it for you to do that research? Is there anything that comes up in you when you're doing that research and also interacting with the world and in a United States that's constantly embroiled in, you know, race issues and resistance and dissent?
Let me make sure I'm understanding your question. Like, what is it like for me as a historian researching what I research in the context of a country in denial? Is that what you're saying?
Exactly. Yes.
Okay.
We'll go with that.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think that this is a fight. This is the fight. This country is ill. It is, and you know, it is bordering on terminally ill. And you know, the sickness is racism, and you know, I mean, racial capitalism. And we could go into a bunch of stuff, but there's never been any kind of truth or reconciliation process in this country. There's been no, and we have to, as a country, be able to come to terms with our history, or we're not going to make it, you know. And the idea that, you know, slavery, you know, is irrelevant historically or happened so long ago. I mean, you know, my paternal grandparents were born slaves, and I'm 56. That's very unusual, but that it was physically possible. Mm-hmm. So my dad was like in his mid-60s when I was born, and he was born in the youngest child of, in 1898. And wow. My grandmother was born in 1861, and my grandfather was born in 1860. The fact that it's even physically possible for it to be two generations removed shows that this happened just a second ago. Mm. You know, and our country needs at minimum a truth and reconciliation process in order to sort of move forward and heal. I mean, if we don't understand these formative parts of who we are, you know, American slavery and its after effects, Native American genocide, these kind of things, then we don't understand what's going on around us and don't know how to address it.
Yes, that's
so it is the work.
Very true. Is there anything else you would like to add about slave revolts or resistance or anything else that came up that you would be interested in talking about?
I can't think of anything off the top of my head.
Okay.
Definitely, I tried to update my website. So I would definitely like to refer people to my website that has information on the ongoing progress of the graphic novel, as well as a link to scholarly articles published on the topic. And that is rebhallphd.org. And you can also follow me on Twitter at Wake Revolt.
Thanks for listening to the interview. We'll be back with another conversation very soon, so stay tuned for that. If you want to give us a shout and let us know what you thought about today's interview, you can do that by email at unpopular@iheartmedia.com, or you can hit us up on social media. We're on Twitter @_unpopularshow. We're on Instagram @unpopularshow, and we're on Facebook @thisisunpopular. So let us know what you think, and we'll be back soon. Bye.